back with episode 602 of The Critical Myth. I'm John, your host, and tonight we have...
Edmund from Greenville, who's wondering why some filmmakers can get off to such a promising start and middle, and then decide not to stick the landing.
And I just want to know what exactly it is that's been spreading among our co-hosts, because they're collapsing left and right. This may be a relatively short episode, folks.
Yeah, see, even though it was almost exactly a year that all four of us were together, apparently there's some sort of delayed reaction thing going on.
Yeah, might be. I'm wondering if I should check to see if there are any strange parasites around or something. But at any rate, yes, Gary had to duck out because he was at the point of exhaustion, and apparently Spring smacked Bronstam in the face, as we heard at the end of the last episode, or in between for us. So he had to duck out. And that means that you have Edmund and I here to round things out for the week. Unfortunately, some of us were not up on any of the episodes for the week ending in roughly the 11th of August. So we're just going to focus on some feedback that we've received and then see what kind of open topics come up. And I'm gathering that, Edmund, you have one based on the opening.
Yes.
But we'll see. All right. So before we do any of that, maybe a general disclaimer.
Whatever it is we decide to talk about, we will talk about it no holds barred. So whatever that topic is, you might be spoiled by it, or maybe delighted by it, or maybe disgusted by it. And I can't think of any more D words. So that will do it for the disclaimer for now.
Yeah, that sounds good to me. All right. Well, we did get some... feedback over at the VOG Network forums from our friend S. Elliot Fisher, who, again, I'm not exactly sure if this is a long-time listener or not, so please, next time, let us know. But a friend of ours out of Staten Island, who is a relatively new poster over on the forums, and so I'm hoping that this is a frequent feedback provider throughout the future. But we had asked him at one point about RetroCon, because he mentioned it to us.
Oh, yes.
And we said, what is RetroCon? And apparently it takes place September 12th and 13th in the Greater Philadelphia Expo Center in Oaks, Pennsylvania. So the guest that he's looking forward to most meeting is Jim Martin, a.k.a. Gary Ganu of the Great Space Coaster. Wow, talk about retro.
Yeah.
Holy cow. He did give a link, which is retrocons.com. So go ahead and take a look. For us, that is literally the weekend after Dragon Con. So I'm not sure that's going to happen, because I'll be fairly exhausted, as I'm sure most of us will be.
Absolutely.
And I'm the closest of our co-hosts here. I don't know if anyone in the Anime Jam Session group would be interested in that or not, but I will pass on the information when I talk to them. At this point, it would have been earlier this week. So there you go. S. Elliot Fisher also gave us some other feedback, this time regarding Falling Skies. This is full of a few references here. He says, I wish you guys would give Falling Skies a little more credit. It's a good show. I really have a lot of fun watching it. I know it doesn't meet the Babylon 5 standard of great sci-fi, but not all sci-fi has to be at that level to be enjoyable. To look at it another way, if Babylon 5 were a restaurant, it would be a Michelin star establishment. Now, it's great to get all dressed up to dine at a Michelin-starred restaurant whenever money and time allows, but there are other times when you just got to have some White Castles. Right now, it's summer, I'm wearing a t-shirt, shorts, and have no AC at home, and Falling Skies is my White Castle. That's my summer craving, something quick and fun that I don't have to put much effort into. Okay.
Well.
Edmund?
As I was mentioning earlier this week, I mean, yes, I mean, I do have my, guilty pleasure, turn your mind off, or at least don't, I find it hard to completely turn my mind off. And I guess that's part of the point, I do prefer at least having some, consistency in, characters and alien threats, and just sort of general approach to the material. I would say actually that, in terms of the stuff we talk about, that's been the issue with Falling Skies compared to the way Defiance has managed to grow and get more consistent over its three seasons. And with Falling Skies, it's just veered too much back and forth in terms of the threats involved, and then at the same time going back to the same wells in terms of the interpersonal dynamics and the love triangles and the family stuff going on. So I certainly understand the desire for escapist fare, Falling Skies has just been way too inconsistent for me to fully embrace it in that way.
Yeah, I would say probably for very similar reasons. That's some of the reason that I haven't been entirely engaged by Falling Skies. Usually I would almost agree with this kind of idea that, yeah, let's have some summer escapist fare, but I really need something to sink my teeth into that I can kind of focus on and if nothing else, be a distraction from other things going on. And this is not the show for that. Quite honestly, I will say this season has been better on the whole than even the last three before it. This is easily if it continues to do okay through the rest of its run, it might actually turn out to be on par with the first season, which was the best scored season from our group here. Because right now it's pretty much dead on seven, which is average. Which, don't get us wrong, we're saying that it's not the greatest show and it tends to be in our bottom three, but that's just because of where shows are currently falling. The only show that really seems to be contesting it for the bottom right now is Masters of Sex, which last season was usually towards the top.
Yes.
So there's a lot of opportunity for shows to kind of move and jockey for position right now. But I can't say that Falling Skies is doing that dramatically different than, say, Dark Matter is. It's just an average... like you're saying here, escapist show. And that's perfectly fine. It's actually doing 7/10 of a point better than last season. It's the only season so far that has in fact improved upon its predecessor. So from that perspective, we're actually saying better things about the show than we did the last 2 years. So there's that. I'm trying to give you something. No, but I mean, let's face it. You know what? Some other shows that came in around here, shows like Gotham and Dig, and even not too far from this would be like the last season of Supernatural or The Librarians. They're fine entertainment in their own way, but they're flawed. And so, to be fair, just like we did with those shows, we're kind of explaining why we feel they're flawed.
Yeah.
But that doesn't necessarily mean that they're that this is a show that we are just kind of tossing to the winds. In fact, if I would say that we might have if it wasn't the final season, but the final season is turning out to be better than I thought it would be, so I'd probably still stick with it. There are other shows that I really haven't been as engaged by over the last year or two that I did drop.
Yeah.
So there you go. Any other thoughts or last thoughts on Falling Skies or the general idea that there not everything needs to be a top flight show?
Yeah, no.
I mean, Gary's made that point a few times.
Yes. Yeah, and I think with Falling Skies, I mean, knowing that this was the final season was certainly one of the reasons why we were sticking with it, and also just simply because in recent years. There's been such a wide variability of these shows going into these seasons, knowing it was the last one, some of them doing quite well. I mean, we were mentioning Fringe back in episode 600, which we all I know some that final season was a little divisive to some, but I know we actually quite enjoyed that future timeline and then the way they pulled it all through, and then we have to contrast that with certainly I'd say Warehouse 13. Is now a sort of touchstone for a show, knowing it was going into the final, and wondering just what they were thinking as they
veered all over the place and seemed to waste a lot of time in those 6 episodes they were given. I mean that was certainly part of my interest to see. It's like, okay, how are these guys going to do? And certainly it's been a pleasant surprise that it has been that slight improvement, but as you say, still not without its flaws, which we feel duty bound to point out.
Mm-hmm. Yes, indeed. I mean, after 600 plus episodes, we do have our certain things that we are going to focus on. And it is critical myth for a reason. We do try not to gloss over too many things along the way. All right, that's pretty much it for the feedback. Although Danger Mouse, one of our longtime listeners and providers of feedback, did ask about the release schedule for the show. Yeah, I thought while I was on vacation that I would actually be able to get onto my remote server, and that didn't work out quite the way I had planned.
Ah.
Yeah. So things got a little delayed, but that's okay. As you've probably noticed this week, things are back on schedule. So we're good to go. Just in time for, in a few weeks, Dragon Con and everything being off schedule again. So,
Well,
what do you want to do?
It's the summer. We ask our listeners to put up with a little inconsistency as we try and juggle vacations and family, etc.
Indeed, indeed. All right. So that moves us into what was supposed to be our first open topic show, and two of our co-hosts pretty much collapsed. So we're going to see what kind of topics we have here, but I don't have anything necessarily from the viewers right now, but Edmund, it seems like there was something that was on your mind.
I just had an interesting juxtaposition happen in this last week, we were mentioning Ex Machina last episode and talking about humans, and I actually did finally get a chance to see it this week. Did enjoy it quite a bit. Yes, I will say that yes, I mean, in terms of creepy automata and the dangers of giving robots sentience and AI are quite well explored. It was certainly a case of a situation that starts off relatively benign. More seemingly benign, but with little hints of possible problems in the background that then really come to the fore by the end. I actually wound up being able to contrast that with a film from a couple of years ago, which I've been hearing about and finally tracked down a copy of, called Europa Report.
Yes.
Which, when I started watching it, my immediate reaction was, you know, okay, all of us who decried the early demise of Defying Gravity, you know, here's a movie which feels a lot like a potential, not a continuation, but sort of happening in a similar universe in terms of showing this privately funded rocket that's sent out to Europa, the moon of Jupiter, certainly evoking some of my favorite hard science fiction films like 2001. You know, yes, they do once they get into orbit and are set for engines go, ground control does start playing them the Blue Danube, then when they get to Europa and things are starting to go slightly swirly, it was bringing some films like Solaris to mind in terms of being kind of subtle with the interactions. Similar to Ex Machina, they were all building to this sort of final shocking image. And unfortunately, where Ex Machina I found very successful, this is a film where, after being very nice and discreet and subtle and intellectual in the approach, went very literal right at the very end, and it kind of negated a lot of the goodwill that the film had built up for me. And it was a case of where I was always literally thinking, it's like, no, this needs to be recut and just lose the last 10 seconds. it's a case of, you know, it doesn't completely negate the film for me, but it was just a strange decision given everything that had been established leading up to that point. But certainly in terms of having a film that follows a pretty realistic, far solar system expedition, even to the point of a reasonably well designed ship with rotating living quarters and a free fall center section with the engines and most of the machinery. I give it major points on all of that, and as I said at the beginning, I just wish they had stuck the landing in a different spot from where they did.
Mm. I vaguely recall this having a lot of the same issues and feeling just a little disappointed that they overplayed their hand there.
Yeah.
Which is why I guess, like you said, if I'm a little more up on, I guess I saw Europa Report a couple of years ago, but definitely more up on Ex Machina, and that I felt had a lot of the potential to do something similar, where you kind of could see that they could have easily written themselves a Deus Ex Machina, as the case may be.
Yes.
And they really just decided to go what I would call the right way,
mm-hmm.
which was to not basically they put the gun on the mantle and they actually pulled the trigger, which was nice. I kind of saw them putting like about 7 or 8 different weapons on the mantle and wasn't sure if they were going to pull any of them down and use them. I think they pretty much just had all of them go at the same time, which was rather nice. But it does play out exactly the way that it needs to, and in the most possibly paranoia-inducing way possible at the same time, which is why it is such a wonderful play or partner to humans, because everything that you see in humans that is just slightly mitigated by intentional changes in appearance and such gets played with a lot more in Ex Machina. And the psychological side of that film is really the highlight. Basically you can imagine the scenario where somebody this eccentric would do something this remarkably stupid.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, it kind of touches on people's fears a lot. But like I said, I guess it's one of those things where you have a really neat concept and it could very easily be overdone or the hand, like I said, overplayed by the writer / director.
Yeah, definitely. And also as someone who long before Marvel was sticking scenes in to force people to sit through credits, as someone who has always tended to sit through credits as much to kind of give me some time to process the movie, and also I do actually, you know, very, very often that's where you can actually sit back and hear major elements of the score being played and give you a chance to sort of listen to them without getting distracted by the action. I was also very impressed with those closing credits of where they were doing. I know we actually didn't really wind up mentioning it in the show, but where I did refer in our notes to a Spirograph being used badly or well, and the way they did all of those patterns getting increasingly complex all the way through to, of course, the complete whiteout. I thought was a marvelous use of something that probably was not that expensive for them to actually come up with, but was a wonderful little sort of a visual commentary on the increasing complexities that we had just been witnessing.
Mm. Good point. It is nice when you see that continuity of vision and design. Just aesthetic,
yeah,
like that, yeah,
yeah. Because certainly, I mean, throughout the film, I mean, they were really having a very fun time with the idea of this eccentric billionaire, I'm sure this is one of those cases where whoever the location manager and location scouts were, you know, when they found that house, were just like, oh yes, this is, you know, because certainly the house and the setting, you know, was you know, became as much a character really in the movie as much as the three or more people who are actually inhabiting the house.
Yes, yes, we're teasing anyone who has not seen it with the possibilities of what may be going on.
Yeah. This is one case where despite my disclaimer, the this movie is too good for us to spoil it for you.
I think that it is definitely worth going into relatively unspoiled.
Yeah.
Yeah. So let's see. Anything else that you can think of worthy of minor discussion debate?
No, I've mentioned the last couple of episodes about gotten to a little bit with our feedback as well in terms of what other stuff we've been watching. I've mentioned some of the shows that have sort of fallen off of my radar, but the ones that are still on it. Rectify just concluded its third season has continued its extremely high quality extraordinary writing and performances going on as we continue Daniel's slow road to recovery it's a very, very interesting mix of both the character studies and the family relations which have been getting more and more complicated and playing out in some very interesting ways, and at the same time there is this whole mystery of the murder that he was put in jail for and then released, and the way the local sheriff is trying to tease out what actually happened. But the strength of the show really is in the character interactions. So even though there is this did he or didn't he do it, and what were the exact circumstances, which is being investigated, but it's an interesting setup where it's not really the main focus of the show. That whole question of the who done it side of it is just this plot that's going off on going on off to the side, and it's these fascinating characters that you've been introduced to that are the real focus of the show. I'm very happy it did get renewed, I will get to see where Daniel and Amantha and their mother in particular wind up going next year. For the Sundance Channel, it's quite an extraordinary achievement that they really have managed to take an independent film sensibility and actually spin TV shows out of it, and had the courage of their convictions to keep them going as well. So I really do tip my hat to them, and it's nice to see a network that is really staying true to the ideals of independent cinema that caused it to come into being in the first place.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's we've seen how many cable networks kind of lose their way. Sci-fi.
Yeah. Well, not to mention things like TLC, which doesn't even bother with learning anymore.
Or the History Channel,
for those of us who remember its original name. Yes.
Mm. Yes. Indeed. Well, let's see. I have a couple things here on my. I was making a list on my phone while I was on vacation, because that's the way I roll. And these are from some very general things. And I was just going to, one of them is more of a rant, so I'll leave that afterward. But this one is just this thing I wanted to throw out there. And in particular, I figured I knew how Gary would answer this question. I already anticipated his answer, but I was really interested in maybe some of the answers from like you and Bronstone, because you have maybe a different viewpoint or a wider viewpoint. But basically I was having a discussion the other day about, the use of certain archetypes in character creation. And in particular, we got into this whole idea of your ego, super ego, and id type of thing. Mm-hmm. And like I said, I anticipated Gary's answer, because the one that comes to mind all the time, and the one that I actually used as an example in discussion, was, of course, the big three from Star Trek, the original series.
Right, sure.
Where you have, Spock as the super ego, Kirk as the ego, and McCoy as the id.
Yeah.
And I was just going to kind of throw it out there as an open question. Like, what other examples come to mind of this kind of character construction, because you do find it happen. It happens kind of sometimes you get a duo instead where it's only two of them, but you do tend to see that writers love to be clever and they like go right to this well. Any other ones come to mind?
Yeah, well, thanks for springing this on me. So, of course, my brain goes into vapor lock.
that's the fun.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, actually, since we were talking about it, you know, since you're talking about it in terms of duos or trios, yeah, in terms of another show that actually has been summer guilty pleasure viewing, and in fact is just about to come back on American TV, but on shows like Strike Back, and actually for that matter Banshee as well on Cinemax, I see them as almost a case of where they are taking that concept, but kind of twisting it to the point where, you know, no, they're not trying to show all three. You're kind of dispensing with the id and going just with the ego and super ego, where you've got in the case of Strike Back, this special forces, you know, sort of super soldier strike force that they might introduce some backstory and family stuff, but the focus really is on being badass soldiers saving the world, or in the case of Banshee, just being badass cops and pseudo cops and villains who are just trying to bash each other's heads in, either figuratively and very often literally. So it's almost like a case of taking the formula but saying no, we're just going to focus on this one element of it, and but embracing that fully, and certainly to the point where it's made for some very entertaining television, and although in the case of Banshee, kind of similar to what happened with Spartacus, where yes, there is all this sex and violence, but being perpetrated by characters who you actually do get to know and care about, and want to succeed, even if what they're succeeding at is extremely dubious and criminal.
Yeah, those are some. That's where you get these interesting examples, right? Of how sometimes I wouldn't even say, would those writers for those shows really know that they're going there, or do they simply just fall into it? But I kind of throw this out then to the listeners, as I hope all these open topics become something that we can get some feedback on. What are some examples that you have out there that? Where you see some of these really blatant type of character constructions taking place? I mean, you could say that another example of this might be something like the Mulder Scully believer skeptic type of thing, which if you really want to get into it, you could probably, you know, apply them to this model as well to a certain degree. But yeah, it's interesting to see where certainly we've seen on certain shows where the writers think that they're being clever. And they're really just doing something that people have been doing forever in terms of how they've been telling stories. So, yeah, give us your examples out there. And then the last thing that I kind of had on my mind, which, again, I was kind of anticipating that this would be a bit of a softball for someone like Bronstam. Just in general, adaptations, right? Mm-hmm. And I'm kind of borrowing a rant from my daughter on this one. Because especially as somebody who is a voracious watcher and reader of anime / manga, respectively, nothing bugs her more than when she has read this awesome manga and, oh, there's an anime of it. And then she watches it and it's completely different, or vice versa.
Yeah.
That drives her crazy to the point where when she's been on a Studio Ghibli kick the last week or so, mm-hmm. because there was a fairly substantial presence of that in Epcot while we were on vacation. Excellent. So she was actually watching Mononoke tonight.
Okay.
Anyway,
sure.
Yeah. So I was like, yeah, good for you, kid. But she was like, oh, you know, I don't know if I can find it all. I'll just get the manga adaptations. And I'm sitting there going, no, do not. That is not meant to be the way that you experience that story. But that's kind of the problem, right? That's the rant, I guess you could say, is that, as we've said before, and this is where Bronstam would jump in with Harry Potter almost immediately, is there is the quote unquote real version of the story. And then you've got this adaptation that sometimes takes extreme liberties. And I know that I'm fairly forgiving with the Harry Potter films, but he's not. unfortunately, we don't have him here to kind of jump in on that. But Edmund, as kind of like an easy road to go down here, what would be an example that comes to your mind of an adaptation that just was completely wrong in terms of the spirit of the original piece?
Is, again, I'm not having something, you know, immediately spring to mind. As I try and rack my brain, I will riff a little bit on just going back to Harry Potter. It was interesting having the dynamic with our two missing co-hosts here, but where Gary was the one who had just seen the movies and hadn't read the books, not having the contrasts was more forgiving, but he found the film satisfying in their own right. I know for me, I had the experience of where I was sort of cramming all the books and the movies and trying to catch up before the final film came out, and I know sort of having them all right on top of each other, perhaps wasn't as, you know, what wasn't as steeped in the lore of the books, but I do remember the one thing that probably most annoyed me was Neville not getting his moment of glory the way he did in the books, because the way that final battle started in the movies really didn't make sense to me, and the whole concept of I immediately saw where they were going. Oh no, okay, you want Harry to have the confrontation with the snake, so I guess coming around to it, it's like, you know, yeah, even though we're still talking about Harry Potter, that was the one area for me where, in terms of, you know, a giving a character who's supposed to have this shining moment of redemption and having it taken away from him, and at the same time having it taken away when it would have made absolutely the most sense in terms of giving Harry a very effective means of slipping in while everybody was distracted instead of just sort of, yeah, oh, just going over by the pillars there. Since I still can't come up with anything else, I will use that as my example.
Well, there you go. You spoke on behalf of our friend. Yes. Well, it came to mind for me too, because I'll be doing a panel on the fifth season of Game of Thrones. And while I know that I wasn't nearly as angry as a lot of other people were about the adaptation between book and show, mm-hmm. I mean, that is a great example of people just really being very upset about some of the changes that came along, especially just inexplicable character shifts. And I think that that's at the heart of a lot of people's concerns. Like you just said, Neville not getting his moment of redemption or you know, his big moment at the end in favor of focusing the story entirely upon the trio that was kind of thrown into the story for the films. Not really thrown into the story, but rather thrown into the limelight in the films. Yes. Where other characters got their moments in the sun in the books. And similarly here, when you take a show and you adapt into 10 episodes, two books worth of material, and you really start cutting down on character arcs in order to do it, there is something lost in translation. And I think especially when you start shifting around where characters go. And yeah, I think that that's also at the heart of, like I said, my daughter, a lot of the time what she's upset about is that characters that in one version, say the, you know, quote unquote, official. I don't know if it would be official or not. For her, it's whichever one she hits first.
Right.
So that being the official version, and then, you know, kind of saying, oh, this is why people do what they do. And then you go to the other version and they go completely different, not unlike the Harry Potter films. And it's kind of hard to be like, well, what the hell was that? You know, this was the explanation over here for why people did what they did. But then over here is now completely different. And it's hard then because you anticipate those decisions being played out in a different medium. And it doesn't happen. And you kind of get cheated of that. And yeah, that's where I feel like a lot of people kind of lost interest in, even though the ratings didn't exactly fall or anything. But a lot of people lost investment in Game of Thrones because of that. Because they said, well, I didn't get to see a lot of those character beats that I anticipated seeing on screen play out at all. I guess you could even say that there's examples like recently somebody brought up another fan cut of the Dune, David Lynch's Dune. Let's go, you know, let's go full circle to our news earlier about Twin Peaks, but how that film took such liberties with the source material that I just don't know if you can put together a fan edit of that film that actually captures the spirit of anything in the books. I mean, the design does.
Oh, absolutely.
But the actual plot has to go. It kind of follows it, but it doesn't. And that's where it's like, okay, if you hit the movie first and then you try to read the book, you go, well, where are those neat weapons that they used in the movie? And then if you read the book first and then you go to the film, you go, what the hell is this crap? So,
yeah. I think that's certainly one of those cases where, I mean, I did enjoy the movie, but I mean, especially given the demands of having to take a book that dense and try and condense it down into 2 hours was a very difficult task. But just as a movie, the one thing that still, you know, it is, you know, if when I do watch it, I always make sure to fast forward because if I remember right, that whole voiceover introduction, I believe was imposed by the studio because they were afraid people wouldn't be able to follow things. And it just drives me nuts because you have this whole introductory piece telling you all of these things that the opening sequence then actually repeats. And mm-hmm. it lays out in much more natural and subtle ways than just having somebody state it all 10 minutes previously did. So
yeah, I mean, and I've said before, I'm fairly forgiving about adaptation because I sometimes like to see things play out a little bit differently and see how if you kind of initiate at the same point and then you make little tweaks and kind of push things in different directions, how does that spiral differently? Especially if you can manage to at the same time be true to the character's underlying motivations and psychology. And I think for the most part, my complaints about the fifth season of Game of Thrones were that there were a couple times where I didn't feel like that actually played through correctly. In particular with Sansa. Mm-hmm. They completely went off the rails with her because they didn't follow through with what they had set in motion.
Yeah.
But at any rate, to go then back to the Dune thing, yeah, that I do the same thing. I do the same thing because it's like, okay, the first time through when I still was trying to get my head around everything when I was like in middle school, yeah, beat me over the head with the stuff. But yeah, at this point, it's, yeah, fast forward. Yeah, pretty good. That's nice. Fast forward. And I even kind of nostalgically like that film. But even that, I have to kind of pass through it. I'm trying to just think myself of, I'm literally like scanning my, again, just like Bronstum's comment before about DVD shelves. I'm scanning mine to see if I can find anything in particular that jumps out, but I'm not seeing anything right now. Most of the time, like I said, I'm fairly forgiving about it, but I will say, like, there are some fairly obvious ones out there that you just wonder, why did you do that?
Yeah, I would say
the converse. There are adaptations that take the source material and actually make them better.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah, I mean, I was just thinking in terms of not necessarily book to TV or film, but even just in terms of TV remakes, you know, certainly the, you know, on the good side of the ledger, what Being Human US did compared to Being Human UK, in terms of well, for one thing, actually sticking with the same characters, but then really exploring them and fleshing them out and making those those interpersonal dynamics much more interesting. But then on the flip side of the ledger, the near and dear to my heart, the original Prisoner compared to that ridiculous attempt to remake it, where you know, what I will never forget is getting to the, I can't remember, you know, I think I had some sense of it after the first episode, but then after the second episode, I started taking off in my head going like, wait a minute, no, this is a remake of Charlie Jade that they just decided to call The Prisoner. And once I started realizing that there are all these elements that in terms of guy wakes up in the desert, he's confused, he's not sure where he is, and he keeps remembering his cool apartment and girlfriend that he left behind. So, you know, no, wait a minute, this is something else I've seen. And then, of course, they didn't really stay consistent with that either. The whole idea of... Number six winding up as number two and taking over the asylum, might have a little bit of resonance with some of the stuff going on in the crazy final episodes of The Prisoner, but didn't really ring true with some of the question authority and always defy the powers that be that was laid in place by the original.
That's actually a really good point, because... That's probably at the heart of whenever I really feel like an adaptation has gone wrong, is like I said, just to reiterate, I don't mind when you change the events that the characters are reacting to. That makes sense. But you got to be true to the characters as they are, or you really start to tempt or play with fire and kind of tempt derision from the audience, because that's kind of where The Prisoner remake went wrong, is that they took the characters and basically just completely warped them from who they were. And that's not the same story. That's not even like a riff on the same story. It's a different thing entirely. You've got to kind of be consistent mm-hmm. Go ahead, change the events. That's fine. That can be an interesting way to go, but it's, you have to play fair with your audience too. It's the whole idea of, our fear that George R. R. Martin is going to go off on and veer off on a different track because maybe things will get spoiled in the show, Game of Thrones. So he'll take the books in a different direction, even though he set up all these things for the first five books, because now he wants to try and be different. But it's not just a matter of events. A lot of the book stuff is people's decisions in the logical way that people then follow through with those decisions. So if you kind of go and take a left turn just to make one, it's going to be it's going to completely flop. And I think we've talked about that too, even when we were talking about this kind of topic earlier in previous episodes. That's when I get annoyed, and I know that, you know, that's also playing into, you know, some of Bronstump's comments on Harry Potter, like we said previously. But really, the crux of my kind of mild rant about this is that if you're going to adapt something, don't change the characters and keep the events the same. Keep the characters consistent and maybe change the events to be more amenable to that medium that you're going to. Mm-hmm. If that makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes, it does.
All right, and audience, now it's your turn. What kind of adaptation do you think completely dropped the ball in this particular vein, perhaps, or conversely, give us an example of an adaptation that you think just perfectly nailed it? If nothing else, you'll give us some other stuff to talk about or to add to our DVD, or even better yet, Bronze Thumb's DVD shelves. If we keep doing this, he'll wonder how it is that there's stuff that's just appearing there that he doesn't remember having there before. It's got to just appear on his shelf somehow.
Yes, yes.
All right, anything else, Edmund, for this week?
No, I think I need to go work on how we can get CERN and the Higgs boson to get us to allow us to transmit DVDs to Bronze Thumb down under.
Yeah, something tells me that he pretty much knows every possible way of getting it there that gets around any restrictions or whatever, yeah. Whether it be quantum tunneling or anything else. But in the meantime, hopefully next week, what we're looking to do is catch up. So we'll probably have 2 weeks worth of episodic discussion and whatever news happens to have happened in the meantime. And then if we do have some time, maybe Gary and Bronstum will grace us with their open topic selections. So until next week.
And so ends another epic episode of The Critical Myth. If you want to leave a comment for this show, head over to vognetwork.com. Not only can you find links to the podcast version of each show, but there is a dedicated forum, a ton of written reviews, and related articles by the crew throughout the site. For the written reviews, you can even leave your own review. So let us know if you agree or not. You can also leave comments on our Facebook page, Critical Myth, on Twitter at Critical Myth, or Google Plus under the Critical Myth Show. Any and all use of copyrighted material is only intended for discussion, commentary, parody, or educational purposes, in accordance with U.S. Code Title 17, also known as Fair Use. In other words, please don't sue us. And of course, the statements and opinions of the Critical Myth crew are not necessarily those of the VOG network, its partners, or affiliates. But let's face it, we're probably right anyway. Until next time, watch, read, and listen, and believe in the Critical Myth.